First, I'd like to thank AUC for inviting me to be DVP. It's a great honor. I cannot tell you what an honor it is for me to be back on campus as DVP and to walk the corridors and the fountain area and Greek and the platform, you know, 15, 16 years after I was a student here. It's even more of an honor for me to give this lecture in front of my parents and my sister, and I thank them for coming today. And I'm getting emotional already, because when I graduated, for various reasons, both my parents couldn't be at the graduation. So to have them here today is very special for me. So thank you. Okay, a moment to calm down. I cannot imagine being anything else but a journalist. And I cannot imagine any other time I would rather be a journalist than today. Because the issues that are closest to my heart, Arab and Muslim issues that I write about, that Dr. Amin mentioned, are, I believe, at the center of so much that we're debating about in the world today. And when Nancy Martin at the Office of Communications asked me what I'd like to speak about, I chose this question: does the journalist change the world, or does the world change the journalist? And then I realized, oh my God, what have I done? I've set this almost impossible task for myself, because this is almost like the question about nature and nurture. Which is it? So what I like to do when I've set these enormous tasks for myself is to break them down into a more personal example of how I would approach this question. And to give you anecdotes and stories of particular heroes of mine that help me answer this question. So I'll begin by telling you how the world has changed me. Now, I'll give you a brief bio first. I was born in Egypt in 1967, which we all know was a pivotal year for the Middle East. And my family moved to the UK when I was 7, and then to Saudi Arabia when I was 15. And then I came back to Egypt to finish university here at AUC. And then I moved to Jerusalem with Reuters, and then I came back, and then I went to the US. So if that isn't enough confusion to change anyone, I don't know what is. But the move to the United States in particular was very pivotal in a career change that I'm still undergoing to this day. Because I was in the United States during the attack of September the 11th, 2001. I didn't live in New York. I now live in New York, but I lived in Seattle at the time. And at the time, my brother and his wife, who I dearly wish were here to see me talk, my brother and his wife were visiting us in Seattle. And my sister-in-law wore hijab, and we were scared to leave the house for 2 days because we didn't know what would await us outside because of what was happening, what we were watching on television. And we heard on the TV news, that someone had tried to burn down our local mosque in Seattle. A man who was drunk went to the mosque and poured gasoline outside the parking area and tried to burn it down. But two men came outside from Aisha prayers and caught him and chased him away. He was so drunk that he couldn't drive straight and crashed into a tree and was arrested. Before he crashed into the tree, I forgot to mention that he also tried to shoot the men who came out of prayer. When news of this spread in the media, my now ex-husband, took us to the mosque to see how everybody was. And to our surprise, the entrance to the mosque was flooded with flowers and messages from people in the neighborhood saying, you know, apologizing for what had happened. And from that day onwards, the neighborhood, not the police, the neighborhood put two people outside of the mosque every day for 2 months, holding up a banner saying, "Muslims are Americans too." When I saw this, and when I remember how my brother and his wife and I felt and how scared we were to leave, at the time, it was a subconscious decision. I mean, I wasn't aware of what was happening. But as the days wore on, I realized that I couldn't do news anymore. I wanted to stay a journalist, but I had to move into opinion writing. Because I felt, seeing what I saw, experiencing what we experienced, you know, those days after 9/11, and being an Arab Muslim woman in the United States at that time, it became imperative for me to write opinions and to explain to Americans what it felt like to hear that the local mosque was going to be burnt down. I mean, the attacks on September the 11th were absolutely awful, and the loss of life unconscionable. But there were many facets to this story that I believed just a simple news story might not be able to convey, and so I determined to become an opinion writer. And this became even more important as I found out what happened to the man who tried to burn the mosque down. He was put on trial, and one of the men who he tried to kill went to visit him in jail and said to him, "Listen, I forgive you. I understand why you did what you did, but I forgive you." And he went to the prosecutors and said, "I want to drop charges." But it was too late because it had already become a federal case. And so what he did was, this man was a Jordanian Muslim who had lived in the United States for several years. He offered to testify on behalf of the defense. And the man who had tried to burn down the mosque and who had tried to kill this man, the Jordanian Muslim, instead of facing 75 years in jail, he was imprisoned for 6.5 years because of the action and the forgiveness of this Muslim man. So again, I felt that in order to convey the complexity of this and to explain to the average American what it was like to be an average Muslim or an average Arab living in America at that time, it was really important to use the opinion side of my journalism brain rather than just the news side. So that's my personal kind of explanation of how the world changed me. And whether I've been able to change the world or not, I'll leave it till the end of my talk. But the more I thought about this question, about which changes which, or do both change each other, I began to think about two female journalists who died this year. One began as a hero to me, but by the time she died, I couldn't believe what had become of her. And the other began her journalism career probably with less of an inclination to change the world than when she died. And those two journalists are the Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci and the Iraqi journalist Atwar Bahjat. I will begin, well, Atwar Bahjat and Oriana Fallaci led lives that were intertwined, lives and careers that were intertwined with those issues that are very dear to me and many of us here, freedom of expression, challenging those in power, and Arab and Muslim issues. It can be quite clear at which point the world managed to change them, and you'll see when I tell you more about them. And there are certain points in their careers where it was obvious that they were changing the world. So allow me, if you will, to share their stories with you. Atwar Bahjat was born in 1976 and died on the 22nd of February of this year, 2006. She was an Iraqi journalist and reporter for Al Arabiya television who was abducted and brutally murdered. Atwar was abducted and killed in Samarra in the aftermath of the bomb attack that devastated the Al-Askari Mosque. Her cameraman and a technician were also killed, and a fourth member of the team managed to escape the ambush. Her team was surrounded by a crowd of civilians, but according to the surviving crew member, two armed men fired shots in the air, dispersing the crowd as they shouted, "We want the anchor woman." Atwar cried for help from the crowd, but to no avail. In the aftermath of the 2003 Iraq War, Atwar became one of the most familiar faces on Arabic television, Arabic language satellite television. She came from a religiously diverse background. Her father was a Sunni Muslim and her mother was a Shia Muslim. On March 18, 2006, Iraq's defense minister announced the arrest of 6 men suspected of involvement in her murder, but to this day, nobody has yet stood trial. I unfortunately never had the privilege to meet Atwar, so I will share recollections of her by two reporters who were lucky enough to meet her. The first is Hala Jabir, a Lebanese-British journalist who wrote in the Sunday Times of London. For Atwar, covering Iraq had become a moral obligation. Journalists have become the eyes, ears, and voices of millions of Iraqis. Half Sunni and half Shia, Atwar's dedication to impartial reporting made her enemies on both sides of Iraq's sectarian divide. She could never satisfy one without infuriating the other. If only her enemies had paid more heed to the symbol of unity that she always wore around her neck, a golden locket in the shape of Iraq. Mei Ling Welsh, who was a producer for Al Jazeera and who worked with Atwar, wrote of her on Al Jazeera's English language website the following. Atwar was more than a news reporter burning to prove herself. She was a young Iraqi who found herself telling the story of her country under foreign occupation on the brink of division and chaos. People saw this young Iraqi woman reporting from hospitals, the scenes of explosions, deserted streets, the family homes of the deceased. And people felt she belonged to them. They felt she represented them, said Oday al-Khatib, a colleague at Al Jazeera. Atwar was not objective, as she herself admitted. She was biased in favor of Iraq. She always leaned to one side in the conflict, the human one. Ahmed al-Samari, another Al Jazeera colleague, said of Atwar, "Atwar never talked about Kurds and Shia and Sunnis. She always talked about Iraqis." And the last report that Atwar filed for Al Arabiya before she was so brutally murdered ended with the following: "Whether you are Sunni or Shia, Arab or Kurd, there is no difference between Iraqis united in fear for this nation." Atwar began her career as a poet who contributed articles on social issues to publications in her country. She had previously worked for Iraqi TV under Saddam Hussein, but ended her life as someone who tried to unite, not divide. Oriana Fallaci, on the other hand, began her career, in my opinion, as a fighter for the weak, but ended as more of a divisive character. As the Guardian newspaper wrote in its obituary of her, "Oriana's sense of mission sprang from a childhood spent under Mussolini, and specifically in German-occupied Florence, where her father was one of the leaders of the resistance. He recruited Oriana, the eldest of his four daughters, as an assistant, and she spent much of her childhood with him in the underground resistance, helping Allied soldiers escape through enemy lines." The Times of London reminded us in its obituary that from then on, Oriana became preoccupied with power, its abuse, and those who wielded it. She saw herself principally as a representative of the voiceless and the repressed, especially women, and used her interviews fearlessly, even recklessly, to challenge those in authority. From the mid-1960s to the mid-1980s, Oriana Fallaci was one of the sharpest political interviewers in the world. And that's how I got to know her. Shortly after I had determined to become a journalist in Saudi Arabia at around the age of 16, a literature teacher introduced me to Oriana's legendary interviews, and I remember what a thrill it was that here was this woman, you know, a female journalist like I wanted to be, who was challenging the most powerful men, particularly the men, challenging the most powerful men in society, and asking them questions that we all would wish to ask them. She interviewed many powerful people, including Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, Indira Gandhi, Deng Xiaoping, and Henry Kissinger, who wrote that his 1972 interview with her was, quote, "the single most disastrous conversation I have ever had with any member of the press." Oriana lured Kissinger into boasting that Americans admired him because he always acted alone, like the cowboy who leads the wagon train by riding ahead alone on his horse, the cowboy who rides all alone into town. And the American press at the time used this to mercilessly lampoon him in political cartoons and caricatures. And according to Kissinger's memoirs, that particular quote about the cowboy soured his relationship with Richard Nixon. But the most remarkable moment in the interview came when Oriana Fallaci bluntly asked Kissinger about Vietnam. She asked, "Don't you find, Dr. Kissinger, that it's been a useless war?" And Kissinger began his reply with the words, "On this, I can agree." One has to wonder what that Oriana Fallaci, the young Oriana Fallaci, would have done with the Bush administration. Covering student riots before the Mexico City Olympics in October 1968, when soldiers shot and used bayonets against hundreds of anti-government protesters, Oriana was detained with a group of students and ultimately shot three times. She was dragged down the stairs by her hair and left for dead. She was taken to a hospital and underwent surgery to remove the bullets, and there, one of the doctors who took care of her came up to her and whispered, "Write all you've seen, write it." And she did, becoming a crucial witness to a massacre that the Mexican government denied for years. And again, one has to wonder what Oriana Fallaci would have done had she been in Egypt last year and witnessed the brutal violence that was used against anti-government protesters here. So that's how a journalist changes the world. As Oriana explained in her preface to Interview with History, a 1976 collection of her interviews, and I quote, whether it comes from a despotic sovereign or an elected president, from a murderous general or a beloved leader, I see power as an inhuman and hateful phenomenon. I have always looked on disobedience towards the oppressive as the only way to use the miracle of having been born. One of her most famous interviews was with Ayatollah Khomeini shortly after the Iranian interview. And at one point, she became very belligerent with him and said to him, because they were discussing the chador and the Islamic dress used in Iran, and she said to Khomeini, "How do you swim in a chador?" And he became so angry and told her that these customs are none of your business. And Islamic dress is for good, proper young women, not women like you. So she basically said, "Well, thank you very much. If it's not for women like me, I'm going to take it off." And she removed the chador right there and then. And Khomeini was so angry that he got up in the middle of the interview and left. And she had to wait for 2 days for him to allow her to resume the interview. And when they returned, this is an important anecdote. When he let her return, Khomeini's son Ahmed tried to give her some advice. He told her, "My father is still very angry, so don't even think about mentioning the chador again." Oriana Fallaci turned on the tape recorder, and the first thing she said was, she mentioned the chador, of course. She told an interviewer with the New Yorker magazine earlier this year, "First, he looked at me in astonishment, total astonishment. Then his lips moved in a shadow of a smile. Then the shadow of a smile became a real smile. And finally, it became a laugh. He laughed, yes. And when the interview was over, his son Ahmed whispered to me, 'Believe me, I never saw my father laugh. I think you're the only person in this world who made him laugh.' So perhaps the journalists can change leaders sometimes too." 2 weeks after the September 11 attacks, which I mentioned, were pivotal in changing my career path from news to opinion. This hero of mine, this woman that I had held up as a role model for so long, wrote for an Italian newspaper a hostile critique of Islam, specifically of the demands of Muslims to follow cultural practices, their cultural practices, in Europe. This was met with such a positive response that she eventually published it in a book called The Rage and the Pride. And this book right now is the subject of a court case in which she is being sued by a Muslim in Italy for offense to religion. That book and that article that Oriana Fallaci wrote just made me wonder, how did the representative of the voiceless and the repressed turn to pandering to a homogenous society like the one that exists in Italy, endearing herself to the right wing, to those who are campaigning against immigrants, to basically all those people that her writing that supported the weak and the oppressed, all those people who didn't care about the weak and oppressed. So I got to thinking, what happened to Oriana Fallaci? And the only thing I could come up with was that the world had changed her, but for the worse. Because when I think of Atwar Behjet and I think of what she felt as someone who was part Sunni and part Shia, the world that she saw when the forces led by the United States invaded Iraq, that world changed her career path. She put poetry aside. She put working for a government-owned media aside. And she fought to work for Al Jazeera and then eventually Al Arabiya. And not just that. She addressed Iraqis as Iraqis. She didn't address them as Sunnah and Shia in the way that Oriana Fallaci began to address people as Christians and Muslims. And the irony that came at the end of Oriana Fallaci's life was that she died at a clinic of cancer in Florence on the very day that Pope Benedict XVI came under attack from the Muslim world for expressing a view that she would have endorsed, but probably thought was too mild. And surprisingly, for an avowed atheist, she was a big fan of his, and she left most of her books and notes to a university, a pontifical university, out of admiration for him. Now, my one lingering regret is that I never got a chance to visit Oriana Fallaci in Manhattan, because she had a home in Manhattan. And I wanted to visit her because I just wanted to knock on her door and say, "I want you, the woman who used to be my hero, to look at me and recognize me as the moderate Muslim that you refuse to recognize." And this is where I hope to change her world. Because when she wrote, she used to always talk about the sons of Allah in a very derogatory way. And she would say that Muslims breed like rats. I couldn't believe that this was the woman who was there challenging Kissinger and Khomeini and all these other powerful people. So I wanted to go up to her and tell her, "Listen to my story." And I'm a big fan of storytelling. This is how I try to change the world. And I would have told Oriana Fallaci, and I would have told all those who support her in Italy and other countries in Europe, of my own journeys through Europe over the past few months. Because I've been to 9 countries over the past 11 months, and believe me, I'm very tired and very confused. But if there's one thing I learned from all those trips, particularly to Europe, is that that kind of voice that Oriana Fallaci used in her attempt at the end of her life to change the world, that kind of voice will take us nowhere. Because I met so many Muslims in Europe who are so successfully integrated that people don't even know they're Muslim. And meeting them and listening to their stories, I wanted to convey those stories to Oriana and say to her, listen to these people. Listen to how they live among Italians. Listen to how they live in Denmark, where I've spent 2 months over the past 6 months. Listen to how they live in the Netherlands and so many other countries in ways that you refuse to recognize. Atwar, on the other hand, recognized all of this because what she did was she refused to pander to that homogenous society that unfortunately so many in the Arab media do pander to. As an Arab, as a Sunni Muslim, I find it very disappointing that the Arab media is continuously dominated by a Sunni Muslim voice. We need to hear the Shia voices in the Arab world. We need to hear the Christian voices. We need to hear the Kurdish voices. And we need to hear them all speak as Egyptians, as Syrians, as Saudis, as Iraqis, not specifically as those ethnic or sectarian groups they belong to, but we need to make them feel recognized. And I realized this not only in that anecdote I told you about that changed my career from news or the path, my career path from news to opinion, but because of my recognition of what it's like to be a minority. This is a recognition that I've tried to convey, not just through my journalism, but through my own personal interactions. And it's something that I was reminded of when I was in Egypt last year, because I spent 5 months in Egypt last year. Now, many of you will remember that there were attacks on some Christian churches in Egypt last year that we all should be ashamed of, because Christians and Muslims together in Egypt is what the fabric of Egypt is about. And when I remembered the neighborhood watch that stood outside my local mosque in Seattle for 2 months, I had to wonder, where was the neighborhood watch that didn't stand outside the church in Egypt? This is what we should have done. We should have gone out there. And this is where the journalist changes the world. This is where the journalist writes something and says, where are you? Where are the Egyptians who are going to protect our minority? And this idea of the minority recognizing the minority somewhere else really came home to me yesterday, because I was in a bookshop, in the AUC bookshop, and I coincidentally, 2 imams from Copenhagen that I had met in Denmark at a conference in July were buying books in the bookshop, and it's such a small world. The world continuously surprises me by how small it was. And we said, hello, what a lovely surprise to see you here. And I asked them what they were doing in Cairo, and they both work for a center for Muslim-Christian understanding in Copenhagen that had taken them around the Middle East on a tour to see what it was like in the Middle East and to discuss religious issues. And they told me that just the day before they had been in Menia and had been talking to Muslim and Christian Egyptians. And one of the imams said to me, you know, in talking to the Christians in Menia, I realized their problems were exactly like our problems in Denmark. And I said to him, yes, because these are the problems of a minority anywhere. It's really not a religious issue. It's an issue of minorities. And again, this is where the journalist can change the world, in that you hear so often that a journalist's primary function is to hold a mirror up to society. I would change that slightly, because sometimes when you hold up a mirror to society, you're just reflecting back the same lazy thinking, the same stereotypes. You have to hold that mirror up and crack it a bit and twist it a bit and challenge the image that society sees of itself, so that you ask these difficult questions and you say, do you realize that the same issues that our Christian minority in Egypt faces are the same that a Muslim minority in Europe faces, for example? And here I am complaining about Oriana Fallaci and how she was using hate and racism against a Muslim minority. These are things that we have to challenge here. And in the United States, after 9/11, this definitely became an issue because of the challenges that the media there had to face. Unfortunately, I was all too familiar with these challenges, because when I was a journalist with Reuters here in Cairo, many of you will remember that the years 1992 to 1997 in Egypt were quite bloody ones, when there was a terrorist campaign to unseat the government and install an Islamic State. And we covered many of these stories, and some of you will remember there was a terrorist attack just outside the Sheikh Rehan Gate here, in which several people were killed. And I remember at the time one of the biggest challenges we had as journalists, and particularly for those of us who were Egyptian journalists, even those of us who worked for the foreign media, was that we were always asked and always warned that we were always told that what we reported could jeopardize national security. And this I began to hear again and again in the US. After the attacks of 9/11, national security and fear became issues that were used too often against journalists there. In the run-up to the Iraq War, many of you will know that the American media was not the media that we're used to, the media that acts as watchdogs, the media that acts as advocates for citizens of the country in challenging what we now know were things that were simply not true about the existence of weapons of mass destruction. So sometimes the journalist changes the world by bringing the world they've come from, in my example, Egypt, to the world they've gone to, and reminding them that we have gone through exactly these same challenges. When the Bush administration, for example, talks about military tribunals, these are exactly the same things that we're fighting here in Egypt. When they imprison people in Guantanamo for 4 years without trial, these are exactly the same things that we're fighting here in Egypt, with an estimated 20,000 political prisoners in jail. So it's really important to remember this and to criticize both sides and to use the worlds that we come from. I mean, many of you here are from the journalism department, and I wish you much success, and I hope you get out there, and I hope you get your voices out there in the way that Atwar has. But I urge you to exercise what many of us in America now call, not just the journalists, but many of us even in those who advocate for Muslim issues. Dr. Ramin mentioned I belong to the Progressive Muslim Union of North America, what we call the dual critique. And this is truly how I believe that the journalists can change the world. You change the world by criticizing all the sides that you're familiar with. And that way, nobody accuses you of being biased or being racist or being or succumbing to anyone. So you challenge what the Egyptian government does here and the restrictions on the press, and you encourage the freedom that we're beginning to see in the privately owned press, like in Masri Lyom, like Ad-Dastur, like many other newspapers who have bravely fought against restrictions of freedom of expression. But then when you do go outside, and I hope many of you become international stars, you challenge those restrictions outside too, because unfortunately, we live in an era where things like Muslims moving to the West are used to frighten people, where terrorist attacks in which Muslims and Christians and people of all faith backgrounds were killed, in which these attacks are used to silence the press. Now, I mentioned two journalists that I hold as heroes. Unfortunately, there are quite a few that I hold as the complete opposite of heroes. And one of them in the United States that we've become all too familiar with is someone who used to be a correspondent here in Egypt a long time ago, a journalist called Judith Miller, who probably more than anyone was quite instrumental in putting the issue of WMD and the Iraq War on the front pages of the New York Times, definitely one of the most influential newspapers in the world. And Judith Miller now has been disgraced, her reporting has been questioned, but all too late. And this is because this climate of national security, patriotism, and fear was not challenged enough by the media in the United States. Now, I spoke to a media ethics class yesterday, and I told them I remember during my time at AUC when I took media ethics, the US media was held up as the example to follow, particularly the Watergate example, and I mentioned Kissinger and Nixon. But, you know, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the two journalists who broke the Watergate scandal for the Washington Post, we discussed them and what they did, and they really were heroes at the time. But then you look at a journalist like Bob Woodward now, and many in the American media are saying, you know, you've succumbed to what is known as access journalism, which basically means you just interview the important and the powerful, and you save all your stories up for a book, when you could have used all these stories in the run-up to the Iraq War to question the very grounds that this war was built upon. So again, practice that dual critique. Recognize that, yes, there is a threat from these terrorist groups, as we did when, you know, myself and my fellow journalists, when we covered the terrorist campaign in Egypt. But recognize also that those in power, that quote from Oriana Fallaci when she was still a young reporter or interviewer who challenged the powerful, question authority and question power and recognize that it's all too easily abused. And this is what I believe Atwar did, and this is what I believe so many other brave journalists who have been killed in the course of their careers did. And this is exactly why she was murdered. And the other way that I believe we can help the journalists change the world is to actually honor their work. And Atwar Behzat has been very, honored several times in the U.S., but unfortunately, I don't hear enough of how we've honored her in the Arab world. And this is where we fall short in supporting our own people who we want to encourage here. And I used to have a column for the weekly newspaper, Ash-Sharq al-Awsat. I've been banned since, and it's turned into a bit of a mess between me and Ash-Sharq al-Awsat, and they've threatened to sue me since, and this is all part of our general struggle for freedom of expression. But one of my last columns for Ash-Sharq al-Awsat called upon Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and journalism departments around the Arab world to set up a scholarship fund in the name of Atwar Behzat so that we recognize her bravery and we continue her message and continue encouraging those who will come in her footsteps and tell them that we will not forget you. Because what's the point of risking your life and trying to change the world if nobody recognizes that? Now, a few days after I return to New York, the Committee to Protect Journalists is going to do exactly that. They're going to honor Atwar. And I'd like to quote for you the Committee to Protect Journalists Executive Director, Joel Simon. And Atwar will not be the only Arab journalist honored. There will also be an Arab journalist called Jamal Amir from Yemen, who will also be honored, along with a Gambian journalist and a Mexican journalist. But again, here's another example of two Arab journalists, one posthumously, being honored outside of the Arab world when we need to make them heroes right here. Now, Joel Simon says of these journalists that they're honoring, exposing corruption, criticizing authorities for abuse of power, or reporting from the front line of local conflicts are just some of the ways these reporters do their jobs and inspire us. And that is indeed how journalists change the world. Now, to take this on a more personal level, I promised that I would tell you how I think I've tried to change the world. I don't know if I'm succeeding. Sometimes your ability or the opportunity to change the world can come at the most bizarre of moments. And for me, it happened recently when I was taking a train from Washington, D.C. to New York. I had just been attending a conference for young Egyptian Americans where I talked to them about Egypt and what I had seen last year when I came to cover the reform movement. And I had also spent the weekend with a Muslim American family of mine. So I was all kind of ramped up with, you know, Egyptian Americans, Muslim Americans, all that talk of, yes, Muslims are Americans too, and recognizing fully how successfully Muslim and Arab community had integrated in the U.S. And I was happily reading a book on this train taking me from D.C. to New York when I heard two people behind me speaking. And the woman said something like, "These people, a plane crashes into a building and they say nothing but cartoons and they go crazy. What is wrong with these people?" So I thought, oh my God, do I even want to get into this right now? Because I was exhausted after this busy weekend. But I couldn't sit quietly. This definitely was an opportunity on a small personal level to try and change her world at least. So I took out two business cards from my bag and I put a smile on my face and turned around. And I can tell you now that I didn't turn around because I felt a need to defend the Muslim world, which I did, obviously, but primarily I turned around because I wanted this woman to understand that these people were not over there on her TV screen, people that lived miles away, but these people were me, somebody sitting in front of her on a train from Washington, D.C. to New York. I was not a stranger. I was someone who was right there, but she didn't stop for a second to think that these people could be here. So I turned around and I introduced myself and I gave them a business card each. And I said, you know, I have to tell you, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. And, you know, I'm a Muslim, I'm an Arab and a journalist, and I have to tell you that there has been tremendous condemnation of the attacks on 9/11 and the violence that followed the cartoon issue in Denmark was widely condemned. And I urge you to visit my website and read what I've written and it will lead you to other people and what they've written. Now, fortunately, they were, you know, receptive to talking, and we actually ended up having a very good discussion about Iraq and the Muslim world and the U.S. But, you know, I stressed to them, that if you haven't heard about these people condemning terrorism, then maybe you should question where your media has been. We, in the United States, we get this all the time. Why don't you condemn terrorism? And we do. But the question is, how is the media in the United States? Again, that question, what changes what? Because obviously, if she had seen enough of it on the US media and enough of us are saying it, she would not have been so quick to say these people. And I like to kind of encapsulate that by talking about the bearded man in Pakistan, because he is my competition. Dr. Amin mentioned that I've been on several US media outlets, again in my attempt to change the world, because we change the world by turning around and speaking to those who describe us as these people, and by challenging stereotypes and holding up that cracked mirror to lazy thinking. But we also challenge all those things and try to change the world by presenting ourselves as human beings and presenting our stories as human beings. And I remember the first time I ever appeared on American media was on Fox News on the O'Reilly Factor, which is one of the most one of the craziest TV programs in the U.S. Those of you familiar with it will know that it basically is just Bill O'Reilly yelling and the guest yelling right back. I don't know if anyone learns anything. But after I appeared on this show, I got all these emails from people saying, "Are you sure you're a Muslim?" As if I had somehow forgotten that I was a Muslim. But it was that idea that they had a picture in their mind and I wasn't that picture. And I know what that picture is. And this is the picture that I have to fight against to change the world. And that picture is the bearded man in Pakistan. That's my easy way of encapsulating it. Because think about it, whenever something happens, the Pope says something that upsets Muslims, cartoons are issued in a Danish newspaper that upsets Muslims, you turn on the evening news in the US and you see a group of bearded men in Pakistan burning something, burning a flag, burning an effigy of George Bush, burning something. How am I supposed to compete with the bearded man in Pakistan when he is sexy television? I mean, in media we learn if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. So you have this man, I mean, imagine a split screen. There's this man, the bearded man in Pakistan, burning something. That message is conveyed immediately. And here I am trying to explain that these people don't represent all Muslims. These people are here as well. Muslims are here in the US. And so, like I said, this is how we change the world, by challenging the bearded man in Pakistan, just to simplify it. And not to leave the prejudices and stereotypes we have in Egypt unaccountable, I would challenge each and every one of you to do the same when you ride the train in Egypt, when you ride the subway, the metro, as journalists, but simply as human beings. Because the Egyptian media, unfortunately, is full, the Arab media in general, is full of these people stories in which the minority is definitely felt, is made to feel excluded from the general debate. This is where you as journalists, and I'm addressing those of you from the journalism department, definitely have a role to play. Challenge all these stories of these people. And I will end my talk by telling you about a small bridge that I hope helped to change some worlds that I tried to help, that I built in Denmark over the summer. Between one journalist and a conference that I had attended, I mentioned the two imams from Copenhagen that I met in the bookshop yesterday. And we were attending a conference in Copenhagen on integration of Muslims in the West. I actually wish I could have taken Oriana Fallaci to this conference. And this conference brought together 100 Muslims from North America and several countries in Western Europe, 16 countries from the West, to discuss integration of Muslims in the West. And I attended this conference not just as a Muslim, but as a journalist, because I ended up writing about it for the Christian Science Monitor. And I invited to this conference, for a panel that I moderated, Fleming Rose, the culture editor of Jyllands-Posten, the Danish newspaper that published the cartoons. And at first, Fleming was very reluctant to come to the conference because he was very worried, and I understood his concerns. He has bodyguards around the clock because he's been threatened a lot. And he said he had to check with his security people, and I said, fine, but I tried to reassure him that he would be fine. And to his credit, he agreed to come. And on this panel was Fleming Rose, a Turkish-American cartoonist who was there also as a journalist, as a cartoonist, and three other Muslim-American journalists. And the reason that I invited Fleming to the conference, and I felt it was important to bring him to the conference, was again to use that storytelling idea that I believe is the best way to change the world and to change each other. Because I wanted my fellow Muslims at the conference and the journalists attending the conference to hear what Fleming had to say. And he gave his side of the story. I personally wasn't offended by the cartoons, but I know many people were offended by the cartoons. And I believe the cartoons were an issue of freedom of expression for the Muslim world, much more than in Denmark, where freedom of expression is guaranteed. And so Fleming gave his side of the story, and then he also listened to the people at the conference who either had a statement or a question to ask of him. He also had one of the young Muslim men on the panel express a view that I was very glad he expressed in front of Fleming, because I don't know if Fleming Rose had heard this enough. This young man said, "I understand why so many of you are offended, but I want to ask something even more important than why this man decided to publish the cartoons. And I ask why this man's life is in danger." And I was glad that Fleming heard this, because he needed to understand that this violence that the woman on the train was saying we had all accepted so easily was rejected and condemned by many people in the Muslim world. But then the interesting thing that happened was the Turkish cartoonist who was there drew cartoons of the aftermath of the cartoon crisis. And Fleming Rose took those cartoons and published them in Jyllands Posten. So in a way, we had come full circle. He had published the cartoons that many people had used to instigate the violence. But he attended this conference. We built a little bridge. We told each other stories. We changed each other's worlds. And he went back to his office and he published those cartoons by the Turkish journalist and wrote an essay about what it was like to be at this conference. And he told me afterwards, because I've gotten to know Fleming, he said, "This was the most civil discussion I have ever had about the cartoon crisis." And this was a Muslim conference. He had attended conferences in which, you know, Danish newspapers had invited their readership of all faith backgrounds, secular backgrounds. He attended a conference that Amnesty International had held. He went to a debate at Oxford University. And at all of them, he did not feel as heard as he was at this conference. So this, again, is an example of how when we tell each other the stories that are important for us, when we listen to the stories of the other, when we build that bridge between us, when we turn around and say, "These people are me," when we take someone and say, "Here are Muslims, listen to them," and when we tell Muslims, "Here is the culture editor that so many people want to kill, who's come here to listen to you," and then he goes home and says, "This is the most civil discussion I've ever had," this is how we change the world. And on that note, I hope it's an optimistic note, because I like to call myself a foolish optimist. On that note, I urge you to take those ideas home and figure out how you can change the world, but know that it changes you back, and figure out a way to create that change in a way that emphasizes our humanity much more than our differences. Thank you. I believe we have a Q&A now, so if anybody wants to ask something.